Welcome to the CREXI Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Yannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI and today's host. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the CREXI Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm your host, Yannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI, and we are thrilled to sit down with Alex Sakakis, President and Founder of Capstone Advisors. Before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. Alex Sakakis oversees Capstone Advisors' full range of real estate services, including commercial property acquisitions, value-add repositioning, property development, residential land development, and asset management services. In addition, he oversees investments in alternative asset classes, including real estate secured loans and private equity transactions. Under his direction, Capstone Advisors has been an equity investor in over $2 billion of residential development ventures, purchased 5 million square feet of commercial properties, overseen third-party asset management services for millions of square feet of retail, office, and has developed a variety of commercial properties. Mr. Sakakis holds a master's in business administration from Cornell University and a Bachelor of Arts degree in finance from the University of Colorado in Boulder. He is a member of the Building Industry Association, the International Council of Shopping Centers, the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties, and the Urban Land Institute. He has served on advisory board positions at Cornell University and the University of Colorado, and is currently on the advisory board of the University of San Diego. Mr. Sakakis was awarded the 2005 Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award for Real Estate and Financial Services. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So that's quite a history. Let's jump right in with a little bit about your background. I'd love to learn kind of how you got on your career path and any lessons learned along the way.
Yeah, so my career path started when I got out of college. I went to New York City and worked in investment banking for 2 years as an analyst in the analyst program for Merrill Lynch. And decided I wanted to do a career change and get into an industry that had more entrepreneurial options. So picked real estate as something I had a deep interest in, went to graduate school, got my MBA, and did a career change right in time to enter the industry at the start of this collapse of the savings and loan industry in the early 90s, which probably many people don't. Maybe predates a number of people that are listening to this podcast, but that was a pretty horrific time for the commercial real estate markets nationwide. I got out of grad school just in time to enter a collapsing industry that was going through really just a gut-wrenching period. Option that I had that I took was to go and do bankruptcy work, restructuring, portfolio sales, packaging of troubled real estate secured loans and REO assets that the savings and loan industry had foreclosed on. And I did that for 3 years nationwide. It was an excellent way to actually enter the industry. I tell people that it's way better to see a downturn and understand downside risk earlier in your career than to see it for the first time late in your career. So I worked in that industry for 3 years, and then I went to a private company and traded mortgages, real estate secured loans. I did that, and then decided that I was ready to start my own firm, and I started Capstone Advisors at the end of 1996, and was very fortunate to be able to team up with institutional capital right off the gate. So that's started the company and started buying really a lot of the assets that I had sold off, and it myself and people like me had sold off 5-6 years earlier. Started buying assets primarily from the groups that had bought big portfolio of troubled properties.
And who were some mentors that you had along the way? Can you share some names and kind of how they affected you?
So, you know, a lot of the mentors, well, I mean, you know, I was very fortunate that one of my big mentors was my father. I grew up in a very entrepreneurial household. My dad was a very successful businessman, had his own successful businesses. And so I grew up at the dinner table, you know, talking to him about work and about, you know, running a company and running multiple companies and hiring people and strategy. He was not a real estate in the real estate industry, but that was one of my big mentors. That's who I really took my lead from, was watching my dad run a successful business and thinking that's really what I wanted to do. And then real estate was more of a focus of, okay, you know I want to own my own business, and really, where do I think that I could do that effectively and get some scale and have some, you know, competitive advantage with local knowledge and, you know, and work in a reasonably fragmented industry that wasn't controlled by monopolistic players.
And what were some lessons that you learned early on that became invaluable going forward?
Well, like I said, you know, starting in the career, my career in working on bankruptcies and workouts and restructurings and portfolios of troubled loans was, you know, one of the first things was just, you know, understanding downside risk, right? Understanding really, you know, the amount of liability that you take as an owner operator based on the capital structure that you have, and understanding that, you know, highly leveraged deals are more risky than moderately leveraged transactions, and understanding, you know, that, you know, recourse is a real thing, right? You know, so if you've got a problem asset and your recourse on it, you need to be able to defend it and deleverage it. And also understanding that when things go bad, it could go bad not just on one asset, it could go bad in an entire asset class or an entire geographic industry, right? So having some diversification in your portfolio, having some, you know, as far as, you know, number of assets that you own, having geographic diversity, having product diversity, right? You know, sort of understanding a lot of those risk factors was definitely a very helpful part of my career.
Do you have any favorite mistakes or moments that course corrected you onto your current path that maybe at the time you didn't recognize were opportunities?
You know, so yeah, I mean, I think we learn, right? I mean, we learned as we go. I remember when at one point early in my career, I was trying to buy an asset from an institution, and the deal guys that were running it were putting into the purchase and sale agreement a lot of like really obscure, you know, downside risk mitigation factors. And I was sort of flabbergasted. I was like, you know, how do you even dream up all these obscure scenarios that you're trying to protect against? And then later in my career, I realized, oh, well, that's because that stuff probably happened to him, right? So you learn so many different things over time by doing a lot of real estate investing in different transactions. I mean, one of the important lessons that I learned was I feel way more comfortable running a portfolio where the assets are more homogeneous in size, right? So that there is not one specific asset, especially if it's a heavy reposition, value add, opportunistic investment that could have, you know, very significant or catastrophic effects on the company if that one specific investment didn't go as planned. So, you know, today our portfolio is really comprised of a portfolio of assets that not one of them by itself is so big that we couldn't deleverage it or protect it if something, you know, God forbid, was going wrong with that investment.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's great advice, I think, is really, you know, and it definitely comes from your experience, right? Look at the downside first. And I think that if you're, you know, considering that before going into an investment, then yeah, I'm sure, you know, you probably do want to build some language in there to protect yourself, especially if you've been exposed to some of that downside risk over the years.
Yeah. And it's also just having, you know, really understanding the amount of risk that you're willing to take at different points of your career. You know, frankly, for most people that are an entrepreneur, you know, when you start the career, you've got everything on the table, right? That's typically the way it works. You've got a much more limited asset base, net worth. So the first deal or two that you're doing is huge, typically a big piece of your net worth. It's, you know, later on, as you build and you build the company in a portfolio, if you go that route, you know, one of my favorite sayings somebody told me one time, he was talking about another investment he was making. He says, you never bet money you need to get money you don't need, right? So there is definitely, you start thinking about this as more of a portfolio play and in mitigating risk as you go through.
Are there any favorite books or books you've recommended or gifted most often?
You know, so yeah, there's, you know, one of my favorite books that I talk to people about quite often was written by Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for Behavioral Economics. And he wrote a book that's called Thinking Fast and Slow. And it's really just about behavioral characteristics that people have on a pretty much recurring basis. It's common behavioral aspects and how people make decisions based on risk. And I really, really enjoyed that book. It is not a real estate book. It's not a book on investing, but it is a book on the behavior that people have as they make decisions in life that are economic in nature. And it really helps you understand what people's tendency to take risk and to take odds, and how people's willingness to accept different types of odds of outcome depend on really where they are on a current economic situation. There's like, I don't know, 30 chapters with different learnings. But one of them was, if you go up to your average person on the street and you say, hey, listen, we're going to do one coin flip, and if it's heads, I'll give you $1,000. And if it's tails, you're going to give me $750. Most people, if it's only versed in one-time flip, even though the odds tell you they should take that bet, a lot of people, in fact, a surprising number of people would say, no, I don't want to take that because I don't like the downside risk associated with that. If they're already starting in a deficit position, let's say they're already in a stressed position, people will not only take that bet, but they will actually take the reverse odds of that, right? They'll take I'll make 750 if I win, and I'll lose 1,000 if I lose. And it's really sort of like understanding that behavior that helps you understand when people are going through periods of stress, how they should be really thinking about moderating how they think about risk. Anyways, that's one out of 20 great examples out of that book.
That's excellent. I'm going to look for that one. So after the podcast, are you up for a coin flip?
Sure. The other thing they teach you is that even if it's one time discrete event, you have to look at it as maybe it's the only time you're going to have that coin flip, but you see multiple things like that throughout your life that you need to think, even if it's some other thing, if it is in a portfolio, if you always take advantage of those types of odds when they're offered to you.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure all of us are going to be looking for that on Amazon. Next topic, let's move on to covering your unique perspective as an investor in today's commercial real estate landscape. To provide some context, you know, what is Capstone Advisors and what are your team's investment ethos and mission?
Yeah. So Capstone Advisors, we're based in Carlsbad, California, so North County, San Diego County. And we're a private firm. We are real estate owner, operators, and developers. And we really run a sort of a unique strategy. So we have a portfolio of commercial operating properties, all multi-tenant. So we own a portfolio of shopping centers, and which is probably, you know, 70% of our portfolio value is in shopping centers. And then the vast remaining percentage of that is multi-tenant industrial parks, sort of flex industrial properties. That is where our current commercial portfolio sits today. We've got a couple of, you know, couple office buildings, but very little compared to the rest of the portfolio. So we run this operating portfolio, and in that we'll buy properties that are, you know, either value add. So we love buying well-located real estate that has been neglected or undermanaged, or we see there's ability to improve the physical nature of the property, make it more contemporary, change out tenants as needed, upgrade the tenant mix, and really drive a better product into the communities that we operate. So we love the value add, reposition, heavy investment in the asset. We do some ground up development, not a tremendous amount, but we do some ground up development of retail as well. And then we'll also buy core plus, which is just real good, well-located real estate, but it's not sort of core that the, you know, core institutional buyers are buying, because we don't really compete at the super low cap rate stuff. So that's a big component of our business. And then the other component of our business that's kind of unique is we're a big buyer of land. And we buy land primarily in the path of growth. So we don't buy land that is quote unquote shovel ready. You know, we're not buying land because we're going to immediately start development on it. We buy land that we will take through the entitlement process. And we are based in California. The entitlement process is lengthy, complex, and expensive. We like that about it. When we get it right, luckily we almost always get it right. So, but you know, we'll buy land and then we'll take it through and we'll get it ready to deliver it. Primarily, we deliver residential entitled land, and we sell primarily to the large privates or the public home builders. So that is a really core part of our business. We see a lot of value creation. It's also a little bit it's also the most variable as far as how long we're going to have to hold to create value. They're lengthy projects to get entitled. They eat cash. They don't generate cash during that period of time. But they have, when they work, they have exceptionally good economic returns. And it's a very niche business. There's not a lot of people that do have significant land portfolios in that manner. But when we sell those, then we take the proceeds from the sales of those assets and we deploy it and buy either more land, but a lot of times we buy more commercial real estate to put into our operating portfolio. So the operating portfolio pays for the operating platform and all the people that we employ, and the land is typically just a big capital generator for us.
Any specific markets that you're operating in, or how big is your scope when you're looking at these projects?
So we, when I started the company 27 years ago, we were buying land, buying commercial assets all over the U.S. So I think we've bought commercial properties and owned and operated them in 14 different states. Over the years, I've shrunk that footprint. So now we're primarily based in Southern California, is about a third of our commercial assets. And then we like Phoenix a lot. I've been buying pretty heavily in Phoenix for the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years. So we have a significant portfolio of commercial properties in the Phoenix market. It's easy to get to. It's got good diversity and both politically and has good demographics. I like Phoenix market quite a bit. And then our other third of our portfolio is based in Virginia, which there's reasons why we're all the way across the country, but we have some significant holdings in Virginia. And then that's our commercial portfolio. And we have one or two in other states. We've got a project in Nevada and a project in Utah, and we're buying more in Utah. But that's really the majority of our commercial portfolio. And then our land portfolio is primarily located in California, though we have a 100 acres that we just entitled as a master plan up in Nevada, in Reno. And then we've got a project internationally.
So you've had some longevity here. You've been operating Capstone for nearly 30 years at this point. You know, what do you credit your long-term success to your business and your team?
Well, one, I credit it to my team. I've got a great team of very smart, dedicated, hardworking people, right? So, you know, that, you know, so a lot of this credit goes to the people that are in the company, or the vast majority of it, right? But the other part is of the success, I think, you know, it has been this willingness to really change business strategies as we see opportunities in the marketplace. So when I started the company, we were buying strictly value add investments on a national basis, right? So that was the mid to late 90s, and that was our business model. As back then, there was a lot of distressed assets. There was very little capital. We were fortunate to be teamed up with institutional capital right off the gates. So we were just going on a buying spree and buying property and fixing it and selling it. And it was a very fast turn strategy. As we looked at that, we decided that we liked what was the opportunity set that we were seeing in the for sale housing market. We thought, boy, that's a market that's been really constrained, capital constrained for a while, and could really benefit from some opportunity to go in and put equity into home building ventures. And at the time, I was like, well, I'm not going to build a home building company, but I can be an equity investor into that space. So we really changed very fundamentally in the late 90s. We really changed fundamentally our business strategy and became equity investors for home building ventures in California, Nevada, Arizona, Hawaii. Those were the markets that we're in. And that's where we did the $2 billion worth of home building investing, is through that. And that was great space until it wasn't. Luckily, we pulled our horns back at the end of 2005, beginning of 2006, and started running the portfolio down with the expectation that housing was a little over hot. So we were very fortunate to sort of recognize that and start reducing our risk and selling down the portfolio before we really got into the housing crash of 2007 and 8. So that was sort of strategy number two. We had pretty much gone to cash by the end of 2007. And then strategy number three was starting in 2008. At the end of the year, we started buying residential land tracts from distressed sellers. So that was, once again, it's like a pretty different strategy. Now, you know, so we went from operator with the commercial real estate to equity investor in home building. And at that point, we're like, hey, you know, we really understand the residential markets that where we operate, and there is not a home building opportunity, but there's certainly this investment opportunity to buy land at wildly distressed pricing. So we did that in 8, 9, and 10. And then we, you know, at the end of 2010, we said, okay, now we think it's time to switch back the strategy and pick up once again buying the multi-tenant commercial real estate. And we've been super fortunate that those sectors have allowed us to, in changes in strategy, have allowed us to ride out periods where the strategy that we had been doing no longer became the correct strategy, and we were able to get to another strategy that did make sense at the time. And I think really it's, you know, our longevity has really, you know, could point to that being able to change investment focus as the reason we're going up close to 30 years now.
So it sounds to me like you've been able to kind of stay nimble and adapt when needed. Can you talk a little bit about how current market shifts are forcing that kind of, you know, that need to adapt and how your strategy might be changing, you know, yeah. Talking, you know, real current 2023 with the market the way it is now?
Yeah. So, you know, one other thing that we pretty much do is when things get like super hot in any industry sector, when there's nothing but you know, everything's priced to perfection and everybody can see nothing but blue sky, that's generally when we get pretty, pretty afraid and start pulling back and saying, you know, so it's the start of the Ukraine war, right? You know, if you really look at where a lot of commercial real estate was at the start of the Ukraine war, it was, you know, occupancies were super high, rental rates trended real high, cap rates were trending super low, debt was super cheap. And when that war broke out, you know, one of the things we talked about was we're not exactly sure where this war is ultimately going to go and the global effects it's going to have, but we're pretty sure it's not going to make things better, right? You know, like this is only seems like injecting a mass amount of uncertainty into the markets. And we actually sort of started putting our pencils down on commercial acquisitions by and large during that period of time. And then as inflation started, you know, really rearing up, which some part of that was caused by the war, but also just the massive amount of stimulus, we've, you know, the first thing we did was just go through the portfolio, the operating portfolio, and just re-leverage everything and put long-term debt, right? So to make sure, extend out any upcoming maturities and push it out with, because we're like, this is, you know, probably should lock in the debt we can get right now. And then we've been watching, right? We've been watching what's going on. And then over the last year and a half or so, there's just been this increasing bid-ask gap in between buyers and sellers. And it has gotten to where the amount of assets on the market are so low and so limited that we're actually seeing for smaller price commercial assets where people are sort of desperate to get a trade done or get an investment made, that people are paying like fairly aggressive pricing for smaller assets, especially in our sector, which is primarily retail. So we've been trading, we've been selling a couple of smaller shopping centers that we have. And then we're combining our cash and we're redeploying that money on larger transactions because we think that there's more discipline at the bigger price point. So if we can sell sort of retail for the smaller assets and then buy more wholesale at the bigger assets, we've been doing that. And we don't love the debt. You know, the debt markets are super hard right now and the pricing is worse every day, it seems. But if we can make the deal palatable with the debt in place today, it's, you know, we're making an assumption that within some number of years that the interest rates will come down and we will re-leverage those assets at more advantageous terms, and that we're really going to like the stuff that we're buying now. So we're picking up some assets right now that are trading at, you know, 18 to 22% discount off of where they were at peak value. So it's not a complete yard sale, but it's still like for the quality of the assets, they're good, high quality assets and really strong markets. We're like, that's a good price point for us, especially given the fact that we'll hold assets for 10 years or longer. So that's how we're thinking about the world right now.
What are some of the challenges that you're seeing being a commercial real estate investor right now? And how do you navigate those challenges?
Well,
I mean, obviously, debt is, you know, part of that.
Yeah, debt's a big part of that and just deal flow, right? It's just there is very little product onto the market. So it's really, you know, when you see something you like, it's being nimble and moving quickly to put an offer in and you know, with that you can get through it when in a short period of time and lock in the investment. So it's having the ability to, you know, to marshal the team and get through diligence relatively quickly and get something bought is one of the big challenges. But when you really look at the real estate markets, right? I mean, everybody's talking about, oh, the commercial real estate markets are distressed. There's really two levels of distress that people are facing, right? There is, and as far as I can tell, there's really only one asset class that has a demand issue associated with it, and that's office, right?
Right.
You know, especially the CBD office assets that are located in, you know, urban areas with difficult commute paths to get to it, you know, maybe issues with homelessness on the street around the assets or security issues. And it's super hard for companies to get their people back into those assets. But the suburban and the, you know, the Class A suburban stuff is still impacted, but it's impacted less. But you, but the office is by far the most, you know, demand impacted assets. But you still have stress going through the system on asset classes that are still fundamentally have strong demand, which is would be industrial and multifamily. And that is really based off of just the pricing and the debt that the people used to justify that pricing when they bought it sort of at the peak periods. So, you know, so being able to pick up some of those assets at new pricing that is, you know, where you've got still got strong demand, still got decent rent growth in many markets. And you feel like, okay, but it just needs to get priced in with the new reality of where cap rates should be and where debt is. That's an interesting opportunity.
Can you speak to some of your current projects that you're working on and what's most exciting about those?
Yeah, so I'll start with land because what we're seeing in our residential land market is pretty interesting. If you know, most of the people, the vast majority of homes that have mortgages on them in the United States have, you know, very attractive debt in place, right? So, I mean, there's a sizable percentage of all homes in the United States that don't have any mortgages, right? So, you know, that's maybe, that's almost up to like 30% of all the houses in the United States don't have any mortgage. But the remaining homes, the vast majority of them that are leveraged have, you know, rental, you know, mortgage rates of 3, 2.5, 3.5, 4, right? Attractive now rental interest rates. So what's happening is people that own a home that have a good mortgage interest rate associated with it are very, very reluctant to sell their house to buy a new house to trade up or because they don't want to take on the new 6.5 or 7% mortgage, right? So you're seeing this real decline in the resale housing market in the United States. What this has done is empowered the new home market to come in and fill that void because a certain amount of people just need to buy a house, right? New household formation, you move to a new location, you know, you want to buy a house, your people are going, well, if I can't buy a resale, I know that the new home developers will sell me a new house. And so the amount of the market that the new homes are servicing, typically in any given market, you know, if you look at the home sales for the year, only 10% of the homes traditionally would be new homes and 90% would be resales. Now in a lot of markets, it's up to like a third of the entire market is new home sales. So what this has done is really accelerate through the absorption period that the home builders are going through, right? So they had, when interest rates started to move, things did stop or slow down dramatically. But now the new home communities are really selling very strongly. And so the land inventory is being depleted pretty quickly. So we're doing everything we can to get all of our residential land ready, teed up, and pushed into the market to sell to the home builders. So that's been like a great spot for us. And then we've got a couple of industrial projects that we own that are in the entitlement process, and we're, you know, hope to have both of those entitled by this time next year, and then we'll start development of those projects, and we're very excited about those. We've got a couple of ground up multifamily projects that we're waiting for a little bit more calmness in the markets before we bring those out. And then we're in a couple of acquisitions for some new shopping centers that we're excited about. So we've got a fair amount of stuff going on in the portfolio.
Nice. And speaking of next year, what is your outlook for the year ahead as we get into 2024?
Well, I mean, I'm not betting that the Fed's going to reduce rates anytime soon, right? I mean, I think interest rates are going to stay elevated for longer than most people think. I think that will continue to put stress into the markets for more and more loans that are going to mature, especially people that were doing a value add strategy where they only finance with 3-year debt and even 5-year debt that's going to be coming due. And if somebody went for max leverage, interest only, and was having their returns predicated on having 3% debt, they're going to have a real hard time rolling that debt over unless they really were able to drive NOI. So I suspect to see more assets come to the market over the next 12 months. I expect that bid-ask gap to close, people to accept the new reality of where interest rates are, buyers not to accept negative leverage so that they're not buying at a lower cap rate than the than they're paying on their interest, which is going on pretty dramatically right now. I think that starts to start normalizing. And that, once again, we see if we do believe that, this is, interest rates are elevated, but over the next 5 to 7 years, we'll trend back, at least maybe not down to the distorted lows of COVID, but get back to where they were in mid-2015-ish type timeline, that it'll be an attractive entry point if you're, sort of a long-term owner and patient.
Any hot takes or controversial thoughts that you think you go against the grain in terms of what the rest of the market's thinking right now?
I think that there is a lot of people that might wait a little. Well, it's tricky to be too early into the market when you get into these correction periods, right? I think that's a lot of the probably the most common mistake as people invest into a market that's been locked up because of supply demand imbalance or bid ask gap. So I think you want to be patient. You don't want to come out too fast. On the other hand, when you see like really high quality assets that are trading at, like I said, these, some reasonable discount, I think the other risk is you wait too long and, things pass you by. So other than that, I think most people are on the sidelines, and there's obviously a lot of capital being formed right now, pulled together to get deployed. And it'll be interesting to see when it really unleashes.
Any advice for some of your fellows in the commercial real estate space?
For most of us that are landlords, especially in the retail, it's a good time to be a landlord right now. I mean, it's tough to be a developer. It's tough to get financing for a new project. Inflation is, really pushing up replacement prices of property, which is also another thing to keep in mind as you're buying and looking at where your entry point is relative to where things need to underwrite to get new construction. So it's been a good time to be a landlord because there hasn't been overbuilding in most asset classes. And I think most landlords that I talk to, people that are owner operators, are in most asset classes, except for, a little bit, in the office sector. And I don't want to overly bash it, but that is the toughest area to operate in. I think most people are pretty happy with the continued strength of the economy. And, all this stimulus money, all this inflation, all that money is winging its way around the economy. And we've been pretty surprised at the velocity and veracity of the leasing that we've been able to do, and the strength really of a lot of our tenants to go through this. I mean, the Fed's talking that, there's expectation that this quarter's GDP may be as high as close to 6%. I mean, it's pretty hot economy out there right now.
No, that's great to hear. I mean, it's good news for people that are kind of holding fast, and unless of course you're a big office landlord right now, I feel like there's still a lot of capital on the sidelines, looking for, you know, more opportunistic plays, and that those may be forthcoming. But in the meantime, you know, you're in kind of a good position if you're already in the market.
Yeah, especially if you get your debt pushed out, you know, 3, 4, 5 years out. And then, you know, hopefully when that's coming due, you're refinancing it. Once again, maybe not at the low levels that you were before, but at something palatable. When I mean, for the last, you know, I've been doing this for 27 years, and for basically 25 years of that, interest rates only went in one direction. They just went down.
Right.
And, you know, so anybody that was buying, and I don't want to overstate it, right? But it definitely, this business works better when interest rates are going down, right? So when you're buying, when, you know, my first mortgages that I put on my commercial properties, I mean, 9%, you know, it's like, oh, okay, 9. That's just where the market is, right? That was sort of normalized.
Yeah, but where were cap rates then?
Yeah, they were at 11, right? You know, so you bought stuff at 11 or a 12 cap rate, you financed with 9% debt, it all worked.
Yeah.
You know, and then to the extent that you were hanging on to assets, right? I mean, you know, as long as your asset wasn't having some fundamental meltdown,
right?
Just to be able to refinance and based on lower cap rates and lower interest rates has been wildly accretive, right? So this period of time where we're seeing interest rates and cap rates start to go, like, this will really test a lot of operators that have not seen, you know, higher interest rates or are not positioned for it. You know, there's a lot of people that were borrowing, you know, floating rate debt, and they were only putting caps on it for, if they were capping it at all, we're only putting a cap out 1 or 2 years. Right. I mean, you know, luckily for us, we never did that. Every time we finance fixed for the entire term of the loan. And, you know, and for a lot of years, we're like, shoot, wish we could float that thing down. We, you know, typically try to get stuff with prepayment penalties that after 3 or 4 years, you could absorb the prepayment penalty to refinance it again.
Right.
But for a long time, people were right by floating until they weren't. And then That's sort of like that risk mitigation, right? Because it goes from that opportunity where you're talking about, you know, don't gamble money you need to get money you don't need, right? So all of a sudden, if your interest rate goes from 2.5% to 6% and you're high in the capital stack, you know, you're blowing up because you were trying to arbitrage that little bit of savings on the debt, and you have put the entire investment at risk on an event that a lot of us, like, you know, thought, hey, interest rates are structurally low and they're going to be low forever, right? I mean, that was the common thought. So there's that sort of that risk mitigation lesson that you learn from having a little gray hair going through a few cycles and realizing that things change, you know?
Full circle. I love it. Well, given your specialized background and expertise, I'm sure our listeners are curious about your answers to a few of our rapid-fire questions and words of advice questions. Are you ready?
Sure.
All right. If you're given $50 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would be your go-to asset type, location, and why?
So, I'm going to invest it in retail, not just because that's the asset class that we most traffic in, but I do really like, I you know, retail never got super distorted on cap rates. And I tell people all the time that the best thing that happened to retail's reputation was COVID, was when people realized that, you know, that we can't sell everything online, especially as you come out of COVID. People are social, they want to go, they want to shop. And the strength of the retailers in our portfolio has just been incredible. And once again, that was never an asset class because people were afraid of retail, rightfully so, for certain asset classes, certain sectors of retail. You know, the malls got killed and are going to continue to get killed, right? So, you know, if we look at the retail that we own, it's all the necessity base, right? It's groceries, it's drugs, it's beauty, it's hair care, it's chiropractic, it's dental, right? It's all stuff that you can't get on the internet, right? And I continue to like that space, and I continue, and it hasn't been overbuilt. So that's where I would be deploying that money. Or the other asset class I really like is the multi-tenant flex industrial. And I like that because people generally don't build any more of it. And And, you know, there is just an inherent demand for that, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 to maybe 7,000 square foot, you know, office in the front, warehouse in the back. And it's super hard to make that stuff pencil on new development. So when you buy it, you pretty much assure there's not a whole lot of additional competition coming online. And if anything, generally what happens is the older product gets taken out of production and gets redeveloped into some other asset class. So those are the two.
Nice. Any favorite tools or software you use on the job? Not a trick question.
You know, well, I mean, so we use Argus a lot, right? So we're running all our acquisitions through Argus. You know, we do like Placer AI. We use that to understand where our consumers are going, where the shopping patterns and the sort of the traffic patterns of our centers. You know, and then we're just generally a Microsoft shop. I don't think there's much other specialized besides we're a Yardi shop as well for our accounting systems.
Okay. And then what's the most common misconception about your job or industry?
You know, I think one of the common misperceptions has been over time that as a retail landlord, that retail landlords, extract too much cost structure out of the tenants. And I think that you think retail landlords are rent maximizers, go try to sell your product on online, right? And the key search words and the cost of customer acquisition online is really much more dramatic. And I think there's been this real realization that tenants are better off with a omni-channel strategy, right? Some online, but also a physical presence, because the cost of customer capture is generally less with the brick and mortar retail. And there is nobody in between the retailer and their customer in the physical world like there is through the online. So I think that's one of the big realizations that people are having, which is it's a better economic model for the retailer to have a physical retail. Maybe not exclusively, but to have both is super important. And that's why you're seeing this big migration of, you know, retailers that started off as digital natives or exclusively digital starting to migrate into the brick and mortar world.
Well, thanks for those insights. As we wrap up, any parting words you'd like to share with our audience?
You know, for anybody that's sort of new to the commercial real estate space or you're thinking about, is this an industry that I should seriously consider? I just tell you, I think it's the greatest industry ever. You know, I think it's such an interesting place where you can really go in and make a positive impact in the communities where you operate. And you can, you know, like I love interfacing with our customers who are our tenants and understanding their business models. And it's kind of like a field trip back from school, right? I love going in and hearing about what they're doing and seeing the innovation, right? Just the innovative qualities of the entrepreneur retail operators. It's really rewarding. And you feel good as a landlord when you deliver a good product into a community and people are happy to have you into their community as well. It's very rewarding industry. So I give it a big thumbs up.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights. You know, I know you're really busy and we appreciate you sitting down and spending time with us. Where can people find you online if they want to get in touch? Email, social media?
Yeah. So you can find me on LinkedIn. That's probably the easiest way to connect with me. Send me a note through there, or you can get to capstoneadvisors.com and you can connect with us through there as well.
Well, thanks again, Alex. Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexi.com/podcast. That's go.crexi.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexie podcast on your favorite podcast app, or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/Crexie for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, we'll see you next time.